Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. We engage in the study of the Hebrew Bible in its ancient Near Eastern context and original languages to promote good and reasonable interpretation of Scripture so that the church might live more faithfully in the present. Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Matthew Delaney, here with Dr. Nathan French, and today we have a special guest with us. We have Dr. George Athas. We've been looking forward to this interview for a while, and today we're talking about his book that he's written, Bridging the Testaments, the History and Theology of God's People in the Second Temple Period. We're really excited to have him on. George Athas is Director of Research and Senior Lecturer in Hebrew, Old Testament, and the Early Church History at Moore Theological College in Sydney, Australia. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Matthew and Nathan.
So absolutely loved getting to read this book. It's so thorough, yet it's told like a narrative. It reads like a story. So in one sense, it's both very academic, but also extremely accessible. The layout, it's divided into, you know, not just chapters, but so many subsections. It's easy to jump straight into what you're interested in, what you need to learn. But if you also just want a history of, you know, 400 years or so, you can just read it like a narrative. It reads really well. So we're excited for this. But before we dive into this work in particular, you've done a lot of different unique research, including, by the way, I want to make one last shameless plug. I absolutely love this Hebrew Bible Reader's Edition. Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia is the best Reader's Edition Hebrew Bible you can get. And you are one of the three main contributors to that seminal work. So really grateful for that. So what I want to ask first off is just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into biblical studies and what you enjoy most about this field.
Yeah, well, I live in Sydney, Australia. This is where I was born and I've lived my entire life in Australia. And I got into biblical studies really straight out of school. I was intending on pursuing a career in law and started doing both arts and law. And I started doing the arts subjects first. And among those I chose were biblical studies and biblical languages. And after a while, I thought, I really love this. And there is no way I'm going to enjoy studying law the way that I enjoy this. I'll study Torah, but not law. And so I ditched law completely and I kept going with biblical studies and basically didn't know when to stop. So I just continued all the way through to the PhD and have taught at a few places here and there, but I've been on the faculty of Moore Theological College now for just on 18, 19 years now.
Yeah. Wow. Good for you. Tell us about this new book then. What is the inspiration and vision for Bridging the Testaments?
Well, there are two main reasons for it. One is the needs of the classroom. I teach a course on the book of Zechariah here at Moore College. And Zechariah is a post-exilic prophet, but the book of Zechariah itself covers arguably, a couple of centuries of history in the post-exilic period, which takes us down to roughly 300 BC. And my students found this period fascinating, but it was largely unknown to them. And I was always having to introduce them to the history and what happened, who the major players, etc., were, what was going on. And they would always ask me, what's the one reference I can go to read about this particular period and the theological developments that occurred. And I couldn't point them to one particular book. I would have to send them to multiple books and articles and they would have to collate, you know, various things. And so eventually I thought, why don't I write the book? And so that was partly the inspiration. The other part of my inspiration came from the fact that this period, the last 4 to 5 centuries BC, are largely an unknown to many Christians. You know, this was something that my own students who were in their senior years of study experienced as well. And I wanted to dispel this long-standing myth that there were 4 centuries of silence before Jesus. These centuries were anything but silent. God was still very active, very vocal, and there was still a lot of prophetic activity and a lot of biblical literature, as well as extra biblical literature, but a lot of biblical literature was written during this period. And that comes as a surprise to many people. It even sounds like a wrong idea. But when we study the biblical texts and the history, the culture, all the circumstances, the contexts which gave rise to the biblical literature, we realize that a good chunk of the Old Testament comes from this period. And in fact, the Old Testament period extends all the way to Jesus. There's no stop and then a hiatus. So there's no interim period between, or a so-called intertestamental period. I hate that term. I want to get rid of it. I want to bury it. As it's a dirty word. I just feel like I need a shower right now to start saying that. But I wanted to dispel this myth of 4 centuries of silence and just show people, well, where did that idea come from? Mm. And if it's not true, then what actually happened? And how does that affect our understanding of both the Old Testament and the New?
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if you can actually dive in a little bit more to this myth. Where did this myth come from? In fact, I thought about starting our podcast today with a bad joke, saying we're here to interview a scholar on the intertestamental period, the 400 years of silence. And in honor of this year, these years of silence, for 400 seconds, we won't say anything, and then we'll say goodbye. Thank you for joining us. Nothing happened. Well, you know, so
I'm glad you didn't start that way.
That would have been pretty bad. So, you know, before we really start diving into a lot of what is happening in this time period, can we first, like, where did this myth come from that this is 400 years of silence? Why is this continued to be taught as just a standard, let's teach the Old Testament story, 400 gap year situation, and then New Testament?
Yeah, it's actually a tragic irony. The idea itself, 400 years of silence, stated that way, doesn't arise until probably 200 AD, roughly at the earliest. Mm. And it actually comes from rabbinic circles. So the rabbis were the heirs of the Pharisees. The Pharisees were really the only Jewish sect that managed to survive the destruction of the Jerusalem temple in AD 70. And the rabbis were their heirs. And because the early church was predominantly Jewish, the early church presented many challenges to Jews who didn't believe that Jesus was Israel's Messiah. And so the rabbis were wrestling with that very idea, along with, you know, many other ideas. But partly in answer to Christian claims about Jesus, they stated that the Holy Spirit fell silent roughly during the time of Artaxerxes and with the prophet Malachi. And they dated that to roughly 400 BC or thereabouts. And this came about partly to challenge and counter the Christian claims that Jesus was the Messiah. So this idea that the Holy Spirit fell silent was addressing the Christian claim that Jesus could not have, Jesus could not have been the Messiah. He certainly wasn't even a prophet. He couldn't have been because God stopped sending prophets and stopped speaking prophetically centuries before Jesus came along. There was more to it than, you know, just the Christian claims, but the overt statement of this belief comes from roughly AD 200. And so it's oddly enough an anti-Christian polemic in part, which tragically and ironically Christians have perpetuated ever since. Yeah. And so I hear this idea preached from pulpits that there was 400 years silence, and yet it's an anti-Christian polemic. It's a very odd thing. The seeds of this idea go back, however, to roughly the 2nd century BC, and it has to do with the rise of the Hasmonean dynasty. The Hasmoneans were a family of priests. You might know them as the Maccabees, who led a Jewish revolt against the Greek rulers of Judea at the time. And eventually in 142 BC, they managed to gain independence for the Jews. And as they established their state, the Jewish state, at the helm of this state was the high priest, Simon. And he was the last remaining Maccabee brother. There were five brothers who were involved in the revolt, and he was the last man standing. And he was given power as head of state, as a high priest. Now, theologically, that presented a bit of a problem, because the prophetic traditions say that God was committed to ruling Israel through a Davidic dynasty. And if we go to 2 Samuel 7, we read about God's promises to David to raise up David's heir, and for God to rule through the Davidic heir as his son, and God would be the father of the Davidic ruler. To put it another way, God committed himself to entering the Davidic dynasty as the father figure and ruling through a son figure. And so according to that theology, having a Davidic king is a non-negotiable. This is how God rules Israel. He himself is a member of the Davidic dynasty. And so if you don't have a Davidic descendant ruling the Jewish state, then theologically there are major problems. And so there seems to have been quite a bit of dispute in Jewish circles about what kind of power the high priest would have. According to Davidic theology, the high priest, any priest really, is an employee of the Davidic king. He shouldn't be ruling the country. And yet here was Simon, the high priest, ruling the country and being given power to do so in perpetuity, and then power would be passed to his sons. It was effectively a ruling dynasty. And so in the constitutional document that the Jewish nation put together in 140 BC, a clause, the opponents of Simon managed to get a clause into the constitution that said Simon can rule in perpetuity until a reliable prophet arises. And the New Testament identifies that prophet as John the Baptist. And John the Baptist then pointed to someone who came after him, a Davidic descendant named Jesus, as the one who would lead the people of Israel to a new kingdom in accordance with God's promises. But going back to Simon and the Hasmonean dynasty, they, of course, didn't believe that God would overthrow them in favor of a Davidic descendant. By this time, the Davidic descendants were just ordinary people. They were laymen. A couple of centuries later, they are just tradesmen in Galilee. They're not in the corridors of power anymore. And so the whole idea that the high priest would give up his power in favor of who knows who from a Davidic dynasty that last ruled four centuries earlier just seemed ridiculous to them. And so they started to argue that they themselves, the priests, were the fulfillment of God's purposes, God's promises to Israel. Israel was a kingdom of priests, or in this particular case, the kingdom of a priest, the high priest. And so the Hasmoneans started to suppress the idea that God was still sending prophets at all. He didn't need to, according to them, because the priests were everything that Israel needed. And so anyone who claimed to have a prophetic message eventually was suppressed. And we have some evidence from ancient sources which talk about a couple of prophetic figures who were actively suppressed by the Hasmonean dynasty. And so the priestly circles and the Sadducees, who were largely aligned with the high priest and were basically a priestly group, started to proclaim the idea that prophecy had ceased. God was not sending any more prophets, and the priests and priestly leadership was God's intention for Israel all along. And here they were. No one need look any further than the priests. And so that's where the idea started, and it gained momentum. Any Jewish group that gained power started to use the idea that God was either not sending prophets at all, or he wasn't sending very many of them, because we don't want prophets to speak out against us and critique the power that we have. And so in that way, the idea started as an anti-Davidic hope ideology. And it snowballed from there until a few centuries later, we have the overt statement from the rabbis that God stopped sending prophets in the 5th or 4th century BC.
Fascinating. But and it really shows then with the suppression that's happening is that there is still obviously the practice and the belief that prophets are still around. Because they have to put forth the suppression. I really love that in your book, is it really makes it clear that really we're dealing with a whole group of people that believe different things in this time period. And yeah. I think that can be often forgotten, obviously, in our own tradition, and especially in the lives of our students who come in thinking that this is just a nice clean skip of 400 years between Malachi in the New Testament. So
yeah, anything but.
Exactly. And honestly, this is what I really loved about your book, Bridging the Testaments. You know, having taken so many courses on this area in my academic career, having taught on it for multiple years, I sat down, I read it, and I thought, boy, I wish I would have had this book 25 years ago, you know, when I started this journey. Yeah. So it's fantastic on that particular level. So talking about, you mentioned obviously some of the source texts that we have that show us that the prophetic was still very much active. So what are some of the standout primary source texts and archaeological discoveries that you would say are important for understanding the history of this particular time period? Which is a loaded question. So
yeah. Well, one of the major primary sources is the biblical text itself. As I mentioned, so much biblical literature was written during this time, and it was both written during this time but also compiled and edited. That idea that biblical texts get edited is sometimes treated with a little bit of suspicion. Why would people do this? Doesn't that undermine the whole concept of the inspiration of scripture? No, it doesn't. We need to remember that this is the production of literature before the printing press. There was really no such thing as a book in the standard way that we think of it today. And we are very much shaped by our modern conception of what a book is. We're also still living with the legacy of the Pharisees, who had a very particular hermeneutic and way of reading and thinking about biblical texts. But in the ancient world, the constant editing and updating of books was standard fare, especially when you had literature that was seen as authoritative. If a particular work was understood to be divinely inspired, important, relevant in an ongoing way, then it was not just simply preserved, but it was also added to because it could speak to new circumstances. And God was using the editors in a prophetic way just as much as the original prophets themselves. I would actually call the editors of biblical texts prophets themselves. And to use a modern day analogy, if you have two books and one book is issued just in one edition in a particular year, and then you have another book that's, I don't know, on a similar topic, and yet it's in its 12th edition, ask yourself which one is the more important book. It's the one that keeps getting updated and reissued because it's seen as having ongoing relevance. It has attained a kind of classic status and it needs to be introduced to new people and certainly incorporate new research and new elements in it. So that's really how the biblical literature arose. And so the biblical literature itself, a lot of it comes from the post-exilic period. We're talking mainly elements from the prophets, the prophetic books, as well as some of the books that end up in what I guess we call our wisdom collection, or to use the term of the Hebrew canon, the writings. Most of them come from the post-exilic period. Then we also have a whole lot of other classical sources. So a lot of Greek writers, they're starting to write history and analyze history and weigh up sources. And there's many of them that give us insights into this period. And there is also Josephus. Josephus is, a Jewish historian writing at the end of the first century AD. But he has access to so many sources. One of his chief sources was a 144-volume history of the Jews in the Mediterranean world, written by Nicholas of Damascus, who happened to be King Herod's right-hand man. Now, he himself, and you know, King Herod was a very well-connected person in the ancient world. Nicholas of Damascus had access to so many sources. And so Josephus, you know, well, as late as he is, actually gives us some really good information. At times, he gets a little bit tangled up. His historical information is a little unreliable. But when we compare him with other sources and also with archaeology, what archaeology can tell us about the period, we can unravel, you know, those confusing elements and actually derive a logical and meaningful history of the period. And so archaeology itself also gives us so much information about the period.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting idea to even talk about, forget all the other stuff that was written during this time period, but the fact that so much of scripture itself was written and edited during this time period, making the context of this historical era so important, if just for that reason alone. In fact, this actually is a good segue to back to Zechariah, because as you were talking earlier, you're mentioning all the stuff going between the divinic prophetic hope, as well as with the position and the power of the priests. And in the book of Zechariah, there's obviously a really important section with depictions of a priest. I wonder if you can talk just a little bit more about how Zechariah was one of your primary inspirations for doing this book, Bridging the Testaments, as you're teaching this to students, wanting them to understand the context of, you know, the entire literary process of this book. Can you maybe dive a little bit more into that? How does understanding this era help us understand Zechariah?
Yeah, Zechariah as a prophet himself historically was part of the pioneering community that returned from exile in Babylon to rebuild Jerusalem. And that endeavor itself was a very difficult one. And it was only the diehard Davidic supporters who went back. And it wasn't very many of them. We often make the mistake of reading the numbers of returnees in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. They talk about 42,000 people coming back. And we often think that that's, you know, one figure, that they all came back at once. That figure, however, really is the number of people who returned across two centuries. The initial return was probably only about 1,000 people, and archaeology confirms that for us. It was a very small community, and they came back with Zerubbabel, who was the direct Davidic descendant in line to have the throne. But of course, he's living in a time of Persian ascendancy. But not long after the return to Jerusalem, the Persian Empire seemed to fall apart. And so Zerubbabel had to figure out, well, what are we going to do here in Jerusalem? They were just starting to build the temple, and the temple, according to 2 Samuel 7, is not just a place where you come and worship God and bring sacrifices. It's also a monument to the Davidic covenant. It's different to the tabernacle. The tabernacle could be folded away and moved to another location. But the temple was a permanent structure because it reflected the permanence of the Davidic covenant. And it had to be in Jerusalem. It was never going to be moved. This was the Davidic capital. So for Zerubbabel to rebuild the temple was the first stage in restoring a Davidic kingdom based in Jerusalem. And the Davidic rule, according to Davidic ideology, encompasses all of Israel, not just Judah in the south, but also the northern tribes, those whom we come to refer to as Sumerians or Samaritans even later. And so Zerubbabel fell foul of the Persians, who managed to prevent their empire from collapsing. But it was a close-run thing for Zerubbabel. He seems to have been, there are a few theories about what happened to Zerubbabel, I think the most cogent one is that he was arrested by the Persians and removed from the scene while they investigated his claim that Cyrus, the Persian king, had given permission for the Jerusalem temple to be rebuilt. And when they eventually did find permission, Zerubbabel was allowed to return to Jerusalem and complete the temple. But while he was away, the Jerusalem community had to figure out what on earth they were going to do now that their their figurehead was gone. And the prophet Zechariah and his vision is very important. The first six chapters of Zechariah are addressing this situation. And one of the things that Zechariah suggests is not looking to another Davidic descendant to replace Zerubbabel, but because Zechariah believes Zerubbabel will be back. Zerubbabel's hands started building the temple, his hands will complete it. He suggests that they put the high priest Joshua in as acting community leader, acting branch, as they talk about the leader of the Jerusalem community. And so this is the first time that a priest holds civic power, and it creates a precedent. It's never seen as a permanent thing in the book of Zechariah, because Zechariah is all about maintaining Davidic hope in the face of challenges. And so Joshua the high priest is seen as just a placeholder until Zerubbabel returns, and we know that he did. And yet we see even in Ezra and Nehemiah that both Zerubbabel and Joshua are given credit for the rebuilding of the Jerusalem temple. Down the track, the priests will come to hold civic power, and the Davidic descendants will, they're still around. We know about them from the genealogies in 1 Chronicles. Those, you know, chapters and chapters of endless genealogies that we just roll our eyes at and just skip over as utterly boring, they actually give us some really important information about the Davidic royal line. They tell us who's in the Davidic royal family down to about 300 BC. And the book of Zechariah wants to maintain Davidic hope and the importance of a community in Jerusalem, a temple based in Jerusalem, especially in light of a later challenge when the Sumerians in the 440s BC built their own temple to Yahweh, the God of Israel, on Mount Gerizim, a location up in the north. And there was this incredible rivalry that developed. And the book of Zechariah wants to maintain people's focus on Jerusalem and Davidic hope. And it does so, you know, right through the 4th century BC, in particular chapters 9 to 11 focus on maintaining hope of a coming Davidic king and an attempt to reunite Israel that occurred in the 340s BC. This was the time when the Persians had momentarily lost control of the region. And once again, the people in Judah and Jerusalem had to figure out what they were going to do. And it was the governor of Samaria, the northern cousins, who came up with the idea of reuniting Israel, which is a great thing according to Torah, but reuniting Israel under Sumerian leadership and having everyone worship at the Sumerian temple on Mount Gerizim. And so Zechariah 9 to 11 is all about critiquing that attempt to reunite Israel. I'd also argue the book of Malachi is all about that period as well, critiquing this attempt to reunite Israel, as well-meaning as it was ideologically, the practicalities of an Israel led by Sumerians worshipping at Mount Gerizim was just disastrous for Davidic hope and the prophetic traditions. That attempt to reunite Israel ultimately comes to nothing because the Persians reassert their sovereignty over the region in 345 BC, and this is alluded to in Zechariah 11. Then there's the oracle of Zechariah 12 to 14, which deals with circumstances in 301 BC. Now, this is over two centuries after the prophet Zechariah himself, so people are adding to the book of Zechariah, but in keeping with the grain of Zechariah's original prophecies. In 301 BC, there was a siege of Jerusalem conducted by the Greek king of Egypt, Ptolemy I. He was one of Alexander the Great's generals. And Judah and Jerusalem came to be the rope in a tug of war between the Ptolemies, the Greek Ptolemies based in Egypt, and the Greek Seleucids based in Syria, as well as some other players, a lot of the staff of Alexander the Great. And in 301 BC, Ptolemy managed to besiege Jerusalem, capture it, and he deported a whole lot of people down to Egypt, to the new city of Alexandria. This is how the Jewish community of Alexandria begins, and very quickly, almost overnight, becomes the biggest Jewish community in the world. And so in 301 BC, we have another exile, and Zechariah 12 to 14 is looking at that particular moment and trying to interpret it. And it longs for God to rectify this situation, and it uses the current dystopia of 301 BC to paint a picture of a utopia that God will establish through apocalyptic means at some point in the future. So the book of Zechariah really takes in, you know, over two centuries of history, and what it's trying to do throughout all of its pages is maintain Davidic hope in the face of some very significant challenges.
Fantastic. Oh, that's excellent. It really shows even more so the importance of prophecy in this period. I know we're talking about Zechariah, but nonetheless, it really proves the point, as you're stressing, with the Davidic dynasty. And on that point, I love that you did name the book Bridging the Testaments, as you've already spoken to, so showing how they just, it continues on. This is the point, right? Like, they are connected,
that's right,
here. Yeah. What I loved, you know, I've taught on this time period in a certain course here at ORU for a few years, and what I began to notice in sort of the Western Civ text that we have in the academy in the West is there's just sort of this idea of Greco-Roman Empire, the Greeks and the Romans. Before that, everything's primitive. There's some things going on. We'll talk about it, but otherwise, nothing too important. And what I loved about your book is the stress that you put on just the ancient Near East in general, and how this is sort of the continuance of that on the lands that are particular to the pre-classical period, the history of the ancient Near East itself, but then moving in with the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans. So I sort of felt like there was a bridging even between what we call the classical period and the pre-classical period here in this book that you did write so well. So on that note, that question that comes up here, how does Persia, is obviously going through the Babylonian exile, and then we have the Persians that come on the scene. So how does Persia compare to the great powers of the ancient Near East that came before it and the Greek Empire after it? How does our knowledge of modern archaeology impact what we know about Persia in contrast to prior understanding based on biblical and Greek writings alone?
Well, the Persians were totally unexpected. Nobody expects the Persian Empire. The analogy I use to my students is, it's predicting the rise of Persia is a little bit like asking people who they think the superpower in the world will be in, say, 20 years' time, and then coming up with Bulgaria. It's like, well, I really wouldn't expect that. I know about Bulgaria. I know it's there, but I wouldn't expect it to hold, you know, superpower status. And yet that's really what happened with the Persians. They were there. People knew about them. They, you know, lived up in the mountains and chased horses for centuries. But no one expected them to land an empire and to do so quickly. But that's in part the genius, the political and military genius of Cyrus, who established the Persian Empire as an international thing. Mm. Before the Persians, the traditional superpowers were based in Mesopotamia and Egypt, the Assyrians and Babylonians in Mesopotamia, and Pharaonic Egypt. And the reason for that is because those countries had whopping great rivers running through the middle of them, which guaranteed their economies. You didn't have to depend on rainfall, which might be high, might be low in some years, and so it was a little bit of a gamble. Every year you could count on the annual melting of the snows up in the mountains and the flooding of the plains, and your crops would grow. You knew that they would. It was very exceptional when that didn't happen. And so those particular societies in those river lands were the traditional superpowers. They could afford not to have everyone involved in agriculture. They could afford to have standing armies and artisans and people involved in government, etc. But up at, before the Persians, the Babylonian Empire, which was the immediate predecessor of the Persians, it was a large empire, but it was a regional empire. It was limited largely to Mesopotamia and the Levant, the areas that we today call Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Palestine. But the Persians managed to eke out an empire around the Babylonian Empire first. This is what Cyrus did. He already had an empire stretching from what today is Turkey through to Afghanistan, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, before he conquered Babylon. And after he conquered Babylon, he essentially incorporated all the Babylonian Empire into his own empire. And this is the first time I think we have what we would call a world empire. And Cyrus's son Cambyses also conquers Egypt as well. So both traditional superpower regions are part of this Persian Empire. It becomes very unsteady because, as I said, no one expects the Persian Empire and nobody expected it to last. And so it, in 522 BC, when Cambyses died, there was a moment of great instability and everyone just assumed that the Persians were gone. This is partly what caught Zerubbabel out in Jerusalem. But Darius the First managed to keep the Persian Empire together through very brutal means, but he managed to maintain Persian rule and put them on the map and keep them on the map. And so the Persian world empire, which then started to run into conflicts with the Greeks in the Aegean, the Persians managed to bring so many lands under a single sovereign, the Persian king. And this allowed the trading and exchange of ideas within a single empire. You didn't need to cross a border, as it were, in order to trade ideas. And the Persians, their religion, Zoroastrianism, was kind of monotheistic. It was pretty close, I think, to what we would call monotheistic today. And their thinking, combined with their interaction with the Greeks, many of whom now found themselves in the Persian Empire, provided the ideological categories for people in Jerusalem to have new ways of thinking about their own religion and their own god, Yahweh. And so we really see at this point the flourishing of Jewish monotheism at this time. We get overt statements of Jewish monotheism. The Persian Empire is there for a couple of centuries, and throughout most of those two centuries, there is a tug of war between the Persians and the Greeks. And the Greeks are always agitating against the Persians. They, especially those in what's today Greece, are always trying to find ways of making life difficult for the Persians. And when eventually the Egyptians rebel against the Persians in about 400 BC, the Greeks are there on the scene and saying, how can we help? And so there's lots of anti-Persian activity. But the Greek-Egyptian partnership starts to exert a lot of influence over Judah and Samaria and the regions of the Levant. And so there's this major shift that occurs as people start facing away from Mesopotamia, which was still the center of gravity for the Persian Empire, and they start to face the Mediterranean, where the Greeks and Egyptians are. And so Greek culture via Egypt starts entering Judah and Samaria from the early 4th century BC. We often think that Alexander the Great is the one who brings it. Actually, he just completes the process. It had started well before him. And so when the Persian Empire falls to Alexander the Great, the Greek influence is already there, and Greek ideas, which have in part been influenced by the Persians also, Greek ideas start to permeate Judaism at this point and also provide some new ways of thinking that help Jewish people think about their own faith, their own religion, their own culture, and the decentralized nature of Greek culture. You know, the Greeks were never united. They were always at war with each other, city-state against city-state, Athens versus Sparta, et cetera, et cetera. That decentralized way of thinking affected Judaism, which, according to Torah, should be centralized. One Israel, one structure, and yet here we have Greek thinking allowing for a multiplicity of ideas. And that tension really starts to influence the Jews, and eventually it gets to breaking point in the second century BC, and everybody starts picking up swords at that point.
Wow. Wow. That's a fantastic historical regional overview. And I think for many people, you know, we can give a lot of attention to Egypt with Exodus and Babylon, the exile, Rome, but we can just almost without realizing it skip completely over the Persian and Greek empires, even though we're, I know about Alexander the Great and Persia, you know, I love the story of Esther, but it's like, there's so much more to this. And I appreciate you giving a lot of context and nuance to describing these places.
Yeah. As someone of Greek descent, I, you know, probably shouldn't be as keen about Persia as I am, but
yes, sure.
They were very, very influential, especially over the Jews.
Yeah. And I do appreciate the special attention to Persia. And the reason we asked the question that way too, is that through Western civilization, Greece, even though sometimes surprisingly, you know, not focused on enough in biblical studies, you know, it kind of still gets in through that Western civ mind, and Persia is almost just completely forgotten.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's a lot of all these cultures we need to learn more of. And your book has plenty, plenty to dive into, both Persia, Greece, as well as Rome and so on.
Yeah.
So speaking of things that it's kind of surprising, we just don't know. I really want to ask you about the Samaritans. I'm amazed at how many times when in the classroom, I'll ask students, so who are the Samaritans? And it's like, what do you mean who are the Samaritans? They're just, you know, the Samaritans. They're just these people. There's a good one. And, you know, who are they? And whenever we learn, you know, who these people are, it just adds so much. And even for people who, spoiler alert, they know where this is going to go. And when they read your book, they're going to realize the Samaritan story is a many long century story.
Yeah.
So you can't answer everything about this question, but I'm curious, can you just discuss a little bit about the Jewish Samaritan rivalry? Where does it come from and its origin? And give us a little bit of info that helps give us context for what ends up coming through the New Testament.
Yeah, the Samaritans are very important. They are one element of the people of God. We often see them as outsiders, and that's largely because of the way that the ancient Jews tended to caricature them. But the simple answer is the Samaritans are the descendants of the northern Israelites, the northern kingdom of Israel, which had split away from Davidic rule in Jerusalem. And we read in 1 and 2 Kings about the history of Israel and the history of Judah. The northern kingdom of Israel is eventually destroyed by the Assyrians in 723 BC, and the Assyrians carry off the nobility into exile. But they leave most of the people, most Israelites, at home where they are. They don't deport them. And so Israelite civilization continues under Assyrian rule and then eventually Babylonian and also Persian rule. Samaritan really is just another word for northern Israelite. We call them Samaritans because it comes from the name of the capital of Israel, Samaria. So early on in the book, I call them Sumerians in the Persian period. And then once we get to the Greek period, I call them Samaritans because in Greek sources, they're called Samaritans. But we're talking about the same people. The Samaritans had no real connection to Jerusalem, and the biblical literature characterizes them as the ones who went away from Jerusalem and the Davidic dynasty. And they are going their own way. They are worshiping God, worshiping Yahweh in their own particular ways, establishing their own shrines and temples. And they, when Judah is destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC, the Samaritans are still going strong. They're still there. They're not destroyed by the Babylonians. And they basically become the hub of Yahwism. That is, anyone who worships Yahweh is a Yahwist, the God of Israel. And the hub of Yahwism is Samaria for centuries. It really isn't until the second century BC that Jerusalem becomes the actual hub of Yahwism. Before this time, it's in Samaria. And in roughly 447 BC, the Samaritans build a temple to Yahweh on Mount Gerizim. And in doing this, they're fulfilling the mandate of Torah, which is that all Israel should be united and there should be one place of worship. And at that particular time, Jerusalem had suffered a lot of damage in a revolt, a Persian revolt that had occurred, and I discussed that in the book. The Jerusalem temple had effectively become derelict at this time. And so the Samaritans took advantage of this situation and built their own temple to Yahweh on Mount Gerizim. And it's Nehemiah who effectively hears about this and rushes back to Jerusalem to restore Jerusalem and its temple and its temple operations. In order to counter the Samaritan rival temple. Ezra and Nehemiah never specifically names the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim. In fact, no biblical literature ever mentions a temple on Mount Gerizim, but it does so deliberately. It kind of traces the outline of a Samaritan temple without actually saying Samaritan temple, but it's very clear to see the void that's there. It's a deliberate strategy, what I call deliberately casting darkness on the temple of the Samaritans at Mount Gerizim. But that establishes a major rivalry between Jerusalem, which has a Davidic temple, and the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim. And that's a rivalry that will persist for centuries. And it's not until 110 BC that we finally have a resolution to this rivalry, and resolution is, you know, in scare quotes, because it's in 110 BC that the Jewish high priest, John Hyrcanus I, who is head of an independent Jewish state, he conquers the Samaritans and he destroys their temple so that there's only one temple for Yahweh to worship at, and that's in Jerusalem. But the Samaritans are never going to worship in Jerusalem. And the destruction of their temple just simply cements the rivalry in, you know, between Samaritans and Jews, and they absolutely hate each other. According to Torah, Jews and Samaritans should be united together as one Israel, but they're anything but united. And when we get to the pages of the New Testament, they're still not united. They absolutely hate each other's guts. This is what stands behind the statements about Jews and Samaritans not liking each other, frames Jesus's interaction with the Samaritan woman at the well, Sychar, in John chapter 4. But it also explains why in Acts the apostles are so amazed that Samaritans of all people are coming to believe in Jesus as the Messiah. And they are so amazed that they have to go and see this for themselves. They have to actually see it. But part of what Luke is doing there in Acts is saying that, yes, the apostles go, they see Samaritans have believed in Jesus, and this is the fulfillment of the reunification of Israel that was prophesied, and it happens under King Jesus, the apostles are the ones who see it for themselves. And so we see there in the early chapters of Acts, Jews and Samaritans coming together, and here is the reunification of Israel under the rule of a Davidic descendant, King Jesus, who has now ascended to heaven and is not just simply Lord of Israel, he is Lord of all, Lord of the whole world.
It's amazing how that this context adds so much for these stories that otherwise it's just like, oh, new character on the scene. Cool. Okay. I'll see what happens here, instead of realizing we are jumping into the middle of a centuries long, deeply rooted family feud. You know, it's like when you get invited to a big family gathering of a huge family, normally doesn't get together, but they're doing a reunion and you're running into cousins you didn't even know you had. And why are they yelling at that person? I don't know. And, but we don't realize. So anyway, thank you for giving some of that context. To ask you another question, almost impossible to quickly summarize, but I just feel like we have to ask you this because it's one of the other huge storylines that happens in this era. Can you discuss a little bit about the Maccabean Revolt? There's a lot you could address here. People might be familiar with some of the literature that's written on this topic, you know, but there's also the later rabbinic kind of reframing of the story. You have Hanukkah. So however you want to approach this, whether, you know, how is it told about, or maybe more the historical angle, can you just give us some thoughts about the importance of the Maccabean Revolt in that story?
Yeah, the Maccabean Revolt broke out in 167 BC. And it's often portrayed as the Jews versus the Greeks. And to some extent, yes, it was. But underlying that really was a battle within Judaism itself for control of the nature of Judaism. So the Seleucid Greeks who were based in Syria, they ruled quite a large kingdom, which extended from parts of what's today Turkey through Syria, Lebanon and Iraq, Iran, those areas. And they also, in 198 BC, conquered the regions of Samaria and Judea, and they became part of the Seleucid Kingdom. Initially, the Jews were given cultural freedom to have their own laws as their cultural standard. They didn't need to follow the laws that all the other peoples in the Seleucid Kingdom followed. They were able to follow Torah, and this was given legal status by the Seleucid king. And that enabled the Jews to flourish, and they started to discuss, well, what is Judaism, and what's the nature of it? How do we keep the law? And what exactly are the things that we should and should not be doing? But this is happening in a time when everyone wants to be Greek, and Greek ideas, Greek culture, Greek religion is infusing everything, and Judaism is not immune to it. And Greek culture and Greek philosophy permeates Judaism. It soaks into Judaism and provides a lot of good things. As I mentioned earlier, it provides the Jews with some excellent categories for thinking about their own faith. I would argue that apocalyptic thinking really is just Platonic philosophy that has come into Judaism, and they adapt those kind of categories to a Jewish way of thinking. And
that's great.
Lo and behold, we have apocalyptic thinking, this idea that there is another spiritual reality that influences and controls what's going on in the mundane world in which we all live. But the freedom that the Seleucids give to the Jews enables the flourishing of many different ideas. And at this stage, the priests are the ones who are in control of Judaism. But you've got some groups who are saying we need to move more in an international direction, a liberal direction that involves more Greek culture. We can see elements of compatibilism between Jewish religion and Greek religion. And a lot of people were saying Yahweh and Zeus, they're the same thing. And there are others who are saying, oh, no, that's absolutely impossible. They are definitely not the same thing. And so we also see a conservative and even reactionary movement as well. And when the change to Seleucid rule happened, we had the high priest Simon II. He kind of occupied the middle ground, and he kind of kept everyone in check. But once he died, the extremes in Judaism just kept pulling in opposite directions. And eventually the Seleucid Greeks, the king at the time in 167 BC was Antiochus IV, who really was a nasty piece of work. I'd describe him as a narcissist of the highest category. Right. he had tried to invade Egypt and attach it to his kingdom, and the Romans stopped him in a very humiliating move. And so he basically went home and kicked the dog in Jerusalem and decreed that the Jews could no longer have their independence to worship and worship in their own way and have their culture run by Torah. He removed that special ethnic status and said, you Jews, you're now just like all other peoples in the Seleucid Kingdom. And the result of that was the temple in Jerusalem could no longer be the temple of Yahweh. Mm. It was rebadged as the temple of Olympian Zeus, and anyone could now come and worship in that temple in any way that they saw fit. And according to the Greek custom, which generally involved the sacrifice of pigs, which is absolute anathema according to Torah. And so this is what occurred. There were massacres that happened in 167 BC as people were, reacting against, all this kind of stuff. And eventually the conservatives fled Jerusalem, fled for their lives. And that left Jerusalem in the hands of very progressive liberals who were embracing Greek culture. And so there was a battle just for the conservatives in Judaism to survive. And the ones who, there were two essential ways that people responded. One was what I would call the biblical way, the kind of Daniel way, which is you maintain your adherence to Torah, even though that has now become illegal. You maintain your adherence to Torah, and if it costs you your life, so be it. You maintain your faithfulness to God through observing Torah, even to the death. And so that was one way of responding, and a lot of people were martyred during this time because they refused to give up a culture of Torah. But then there were those who were not prepared to give up their lives, and these were the people who didn't really believe in life after death or the concept of resurrection. And that was mainly the priests. And so there were conservative priests, the five brothers, the Maccabee brothers, who were led initially by the brother Judas Maccabeus. Maccabee in Hebrew just means the hammer. So Judas's code name was Judas the Hammer. And all his other brothers also had code names. Really cool, actually. But they were not prepared to give up their lives. Their entire hope was situated in the here and now. And they were not prepared to go down quietly. So they started to pick up the sword and to do battle against the Seleucid authorities, but also against their fellow compatriots, their fellow Jews, whom they viewed as progressive and liberal, who had sold out the nation. And so a revolt occurs that is led by the Maccabees. And initially it's just a nuisance to the Seleucids. These guys are fighting a guerrilla war up in the mountains. But Judas Maccabeus is really successful, and eventually he manages to gain a lot of adherence, a lot of people fighting with him, the Maccabean resistance fighters. And they challenge the Seleucid authorities, but they're still a small-time operation. And in 164 BC, we get to November 164 BC, and the Seleucids realize, right, we need to stamp these guys out. And they send a massive force. And for all intents and purposes, it looks like the Maccabees are going down. This is their last stand. Until they find out that the Seleucid king Antiochus IV is dead in another country, somewhere else in the empire. He's just contracted a disease, and a few days later, he's dead. And as soon as that happens, suddenly the Seleucid army that is about to beat the Maccabees, they just pack up and go home. And so the Maccabees manage to go and capture part of Jerusalem. It's a common misconception that in 164 BC they managed to recapture Jerusalem and gain independence for the Jews. They didn't quite do that. Jerusalem was a divided city for quite a long time. And the struggle continues against the Seleucids for the next 25 years, or 20 years or so. 25 years. And there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, and most of the Maccabee brothers end up dying at the hands of the Seleucids. And the last one remaining is Simon. And eventually he manages to play off, and the second last brother Jonathan, he manages to play off the Seleucids, who start descending into civil war. He plays off the people, the claimants to the Seleucid throne, off each other, and they end up with their own Jewish state as a result of it. And they They managed to get their independence in 142 BC. The festival of Hanukkah, which is still celebrated by many Jews today, is the commemoration of the Maccabees' recovery of the temple in 164 BC and the rededication of the temple. They had to dismantle the altar, which had been polluted with pig sacrifice, rededicate the temple, follow all the procedures in Torah. And there is the legend that they didn't have enough oil to keep all the lamps burning in the temple throughout the period of dedication, the 8 days of dedication. But miraculously, the oil never burnt out. And so the flame of the candelabra in the temple kept burning for the entire 8 days. And so that's what is remembered at Hanukkah. The word Hanukkah just means rededication.
Fantastic. So just so all of our listeners know, so when you read George's book, Bridging the Testaments, each chapter is kind of like that. It's just clear, narratival, and just lays out the information in a way that you can just take it all in. I absolutely love listening to you sort of answer these questions, because it just shows the erudition and all the information that you put in such a presentable way in your chapters. So kol hakavod, really great work.
Thank you.
And how you've done this. All right, George, so I have a question for you, because I get this question a lot in my classes, and so I really would like your answer on this. So if a student were to say to you that we shouldn't read the Book of Enoch or other Second Temple Jewish literature to help us understand the New Testament better, or even to understand the history that is happening in all that you cover in Bridging the Testaments, how would you respond? What would you say?
No, read the Book of 1 Enoch. Understand that it's not canonical scripture, but absolutely read it. It will be a very strange, interesting, curious read if all that you're used to is biblical literature. Some of it will sound familiar. Bits of the Book of Daniel will read a little bit like it, but it will seem very odd and almost sci-fi-like. But the reason I encourage it is because it provides context for understanding Judaism and how it developed in the last few centuries BC. Refusing to read 1 Enoch, while it might sound admirable that, you know, we only need the biblical texts, and yes, the scriptures are sufficient for knowledge of God and salvation, it's all we need. But refusing to read the biblical text is a little bit like saying, well, we only need the US Constitution. I'm not going to watch any Hollywood movies that might tell me anything about American culture. All I need is the Constitution. Mm. And it's like, well, yeah, Hollywood is not certainly governing the country, but it exerts a lot of influence. And so you're cutting yourself off from quite a bit of knowledge if you just refuse to watch a Hollywood movie. And really, that's what we have with Enoch, the Book of 1 Enoch. It's a very extensive book. It's in the genre that we call apocalyptic, which, as I've mentioned before, basically is Platonic philosophy baptized into Judaism and turned into something that expresses Jewish ideas. And the basic idea of 1 Enoch is that there is a spiritual reality behind the mundane reality that we know, and that spiritual reality is more real than the physical mundane reality that we are all a part of. And God directs history and the nature of the universe through that spiritual reality, and that affects what happens in the here and now in the mundane physical world. It's exactly the same kind of mindset that we see in the Book of Daniel, the visions of Daniel, where Daniel sees this other spiritual reality, and what goes on there affects what goes on in the mundane physical world. And so the 1 Enoch gives us, 1 Enoch is a very complex book. It's really a collage of five different books, which were composed at various stages from roughly the 3rd century BC through to the 1st century BC. And it gives us insight into how Judaism thought of the world. It gives us an essential worldview perspective. And it's the same view, worldview perspective of how the world operates and what's behind it all that we see in the New Testament. I think all the New Testament writers share this same apocalyptic worldview. Paul has it. Jesus himself has it in the Gospels. You know, as soon as Jesus says, "Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven," there you see an apocalyptic worldview that earth is subject to heaven and heaven influences what goes on here, and there needs to be some kind of alignment between the two. So it's going to, reading 1 Enoch is going to give you a really good leg up into understanding the worldview of ancient Jews in the BC period, but also of the New Testament writers.
Excellent.
Well, George, this has been such a rich conversation. I feel like we've gathered around a fire with a historian with us, telling us stories of old, and this has been such a good time.
Yeah.
I can't encourage people enough to check out this book. I think this is a resource that'll really help you dive into different aspects of this much misunderstood era. Now, so as we finish, I'd like to ask, are there any concluding thoughts that you'd like to share with people who might be listening? And then also for people who want to connect more with your content, we'll put links to the book in the description below. But if there's anything else that you're working on or anything else that you've already published that you want to share, that would also be great.
Yeah, I want to commend the book to people. I wrote it predominantly for my students, but I also want people at large to read it. I want Christians to read this book and just rethink what they understand is happening in at the end of the Old Testament period. If I can put it in a rather stark way, the Gospels, the events of the Gospels are occurring in the Old Testament period. Even though the Gospels themselves are in our New Testament, rightly so, the events of the Gospels are happening in the Old Testament period. And when we understand the centuries, what goes on in those centuries and what theological developments occur, we are in a far better way, far better position to understand Jesus and what's going on in the Gospels. There are certain things that occur in the Gospels that are said which take on an extra new significance that just puts Jesus into much better perspective. And if people come away with a better understanding of Jesus, a better understanding of the Gospels, I'm happy. So I commend the book to people. I'm always working on various other things. So there's a few projects in the pipeline. Eventually, I hope at the end of this year, I'll start working on a new commentary on the book of Ezekiel. In the Apollos series of Old Testament commentaries, but there's always other ones as well. May well be a shorter version of Bridging the Testaments that comes out too. That's also been discussed. I don't know. We might call it Abridging the Testaments or something. I don't know, but it'll probably be a shorter, more popular work, but. I hope that people will read this larger work. I know it's, you know, quite daunting. It's, you know, the size of a block of flats. It gives you, yeah, there it is.
Yeah,
it's a good book. It gives, I think, the necessary breadth and depth to understanding those five centuries. And that's something I think that we haven't had for a very, very long time. And it's about time we changed our minds about this whole concept of four centuries of silence.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, I'm so glad you ended with that, because again, I don't know why today I'm feeling like sharing random jokes every once in a while, but when you described how you're going to do this myself, I don't know if you're much of a Marvel fan, but I feel like this was your Thanos moment. I'll do it myself. And here you are.
That's right.
With your book. So anyway, thanks for joining us today. I had a great time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.